Welcome to On the Mind, the official podcast of the Weill Cornell Medicine Department of Psychiatry. I'm your host, Dr. Daniel Knuffelmacher. In each episode, I speak with experts in various aspects of psychiatry, psychotherapy, research, and other important topics on the mind. Our topic today is delirium, an affliction of the mind that hits close to home for me. In recent years, both of my aging parents have experienced delirium. And as I record this, my 94-year-old father is still struggling with significant mental status changes that developed during a recent hospitalization. Delirium risk increases with advanced age, affecting up to 50% of hospitalized older adults. More than 2.6 million of those aged 65 and older develop delirium each year in the United States, and it carries a serious prognosis, with meta-analyses showing a doubling of mortality risk, significant mental and functional decline, reduced quality of life, and increased rates of hospital readmission. We know that the longer delirium persists, the worse these outcomes become. What makes this especially troubling is how often it goes undetected. Studies show that 60% of cases go unrecognized by treating clinicians, a failure that can have severe consequences. Delirium has been targeted as a national public health concern, and yet evidence-based prevention protocols have been inconsistently implemented across the country, with the majority of medical centers still lacking dedicated delirium prevention programs. As a condition occurring at the interface between psychiatry and medicine, delirium is a prime focus for consultation liaison psychiatrists working in hospitals. But I believe awareness should extend to anyone caring for older adults. Today, I hope we can help build that awareness by exploring what delirium is, why it so often goes unrecognized, and what we can do to prevent and treat this common condition. I'm fortunate to have a gifted consultation liaison, or CL, psychiatrist with great expertise on this topic joining me today. Dr. Jeff Ha is the Associate Program Director of Weill Cornell Medicine's CL Psychiatry Fellowship Program and someone who supervises and teaches residents rotating on the CL Psychiatry Service at Weill Cornell. Jeff, thank you for coming on the podcast to talk about delirium with me today.
Thanks for having me, Daniel. You know, delirium is such a big topic to discuss, and I'm very happy that you chose me. I feel honored that you chose me to kind of discuss about this topic.
Well, I told you it hits close to home for me, and you're somebody who I think of as a consummate CL psychiatrist. You're a gifted person in this field and clearly passionate about this specialization within psychiatry. Can you share the story of how you decided to pursue a career in CL and also specifically how you developed clinical and research interest in treating delirium?
Yeah. So the reason why I got into CL psychiatry was when I started psychiatry residency. During my intern year, we do internal medicine rotation, and I missed a lot of the internal medicine part and actually how to treat patients medically as well. So during my second year, I did my CL rotation and I felt the calling, and hence I decided to go into CL psychiatry. And not only because of that, but also because I felt like I wanted to really fully understand all the medications that we're kind of giving our patients, because just because of mood disorder, then we have this particular medication that we'll throw at them, or, you know, patients depressed and we give these medications. I felt like there was a lot more specific reasons for us to choose a specific medications, right? And that gets into understanding the specific pharmacodynamics and understanding the pharmacokinetics of these medications. And I felt CL psychiatry, when we are giving these medications to really medically compromised patients, that we have to really understand what we are giving these medications for and why and how. So that kind of drew me into sales psychiatry more to kind of make me into a better psychiatrist and overall. And the reason why I got into delirium is actually funny because I went into CL psychiatry fellowship to Stanford right before COVID started, right? And it was 2020. I matched in Stanford and I was very happy about doing a lot of different projects there, but everything got shut down as soon as I started the fellowship. Thankfully enough, my mentor, Dr. Jose Maldonado, he usually travels a lot because he's like the delirium guru. He's international, he travels everywhere, but because of COVID, he stayed at the hospital the whole time. So, and I got to spend a lot of time with him. And he, because there were so many COVID delirium and the ICU expanded, both like most of the ICU basically became like a COVID ICUs. And there were a lot of patients who were on ventilators, with significant hyperactive delirium that were being hard to manage with the protocol that Dr. Maldonado kind of developed. So there was a lot of experiences that I got, and it was very interesting. And I felt that the bread and butter of CL psychiatry is delirium, and I got a really, really extensive training in it, thanks to COVID, I guess. And so that's how I came here and kind of speaking with you now.
Yeah, and were you involved in some research during that time as well?
So we did, there wasn't no specific research, but there were a few things that we discussed, and some like a case report on it and things like that, where when everything failed, especially in patients with ECMO, it gets a little technical here, like in patients who are in CVICU and they are on ECMO machine, it's like a machine that kind of helps become a lung, for like heart, like for a patient whose lung functions are really compromised, especially in like patients like COVID, pneumonia, and ARDS. These patients, like typical medications, get really sucked up by all the ECMO machines. So these patients are on really, really high doses of sedative drips that we'll kind of discuss it a little bit later, but they still get agitated. They still have significant intermittent, like trying to pull out tubes and things like that. So I was involved in trying to come up with a specific protocols to kind of help with actually managing these ECMO patients.
Well, it's fascinating how COVID has impacted us all, but in your case, it actually was a career inspiration for you. It kind of changed the course of what you've really focused on and built up a lot of expertise. I want to turn to our topic, which is delirium. And, it's interesting because delirious as a term, if you look it up in the dictionary and popular conversation, can also have a positive association. I think of this Prince song when I was growing up, talking about being delirious because you were in love. But really, that's not the picture of delirium that we have in a medical setting. And I'm wondering if you could just provide us with a really clear definition of delirium.
So I'll just go off, just because I'm a psychiatrist, I'll go off of the DSM-5 criteria, because I feel a lot of us do have qualms with DSM, but I think it is a good place to start, where everybody can speak the same language and understand what we're talking about when we're, as a psychiatrist, when we're talking about delirium, right? See, so the first thing is the disturbance in attention. That is the biggest and most important thing. Yeah, that's why we always ask, I always say our trainees or whenever I speak with them in primary team, is how is their attention? And we have to specifically test for the patient's attention. Another criteria is there's an acute onset that does happen that is completely off of the patient's baseline and mental status, but also with the fluctuating course. Sometimes, though, it might not be fluctuating. They might actually have continuous behavior disturbances and or confusion, right? So this fluctuating course is there, but it's not always the case for the delirium that we see in the hospital. Another criterion is a cognitive impairment, and that could include patients with like disorientation, short-term memory deficits, as well as language or even perceptual disturbances. For example, patients are hearing hallucinations. They feel like the doctors and nurses are talking about it, or they're saying, oh, they were having a party the last night when they were talking about me, and they said they're going to kill me with like a poison they're going to put in. There's like a paranoia there as well. But all the symptoms has to be, there has to be an evidence that is, there's a direct physiological consequences of a medical condition, right? So there has to be an underlying medical cause for these patients. Having said that, sometimes these delirium symptoms will present prior to having this, you know, medical condition being diagnosed. Let's say a patient with UTI, I mean, it's like a typical example, they might not, you might not see like the foul smell of urine or pussy urine, but then you might actually start seeing changes in their cognition as well as attention and like paranoia and things like that prior to actually being diagnosed with a specific medical condition. So delirium symptoms itself can be the initial signs. Then lastly, not better explained by any pre-existing neurocognitive disorder. Patients with early, you know, onset dementia or even like advanced dementia, or even patients with like, you know, prior psychiatric histories, you know, let's say patients with schizophrenia or bipolar disorders, these symptoms might not be the symptoms that we're acute symptoms that we're seeing right now cannot be fully explained by the pre-existing conditions of those. Having said that, you know, as you mentioned earlier in the introduction, patients with prior psychiatric history or patients with a prior neurocognitive disorder, for example, are a lot at higher risk to develop delirium.
Mm-hmm. So that's a distinction. I mean, obviously there's an underlying condition which puts them at higher risk, but your this acuteness, this change from baseline is really core to the diagnosis. So this, because I've seen that sometimes with consults where it's like, oh, this is schizophrenia. It's like, well, this is not what this person who has schizophrenia looks like or looked like a week ago.
That's correct. That's why it's very important for us to get a good collateral and understanding of what the patient's baseline cognitive function is.
One question I want to ask you about is attention, because that's a very important piece. It's the first thing you mentioned. I imagine that when you're consulting for teams, attention isn't something that someone who is always, especially someone who's not a psychiatrist, is always paying attention to. How do you advise clinical teams to think about looking for inattention or attention changes?
So the best, I feel the best test is like the months of the year backward, because it is hard enough, but also not too easy, if that kind of makes sense, right? For example, there are multiple attention tests, months of the year backward, days of the week backward, series of seven, things like that. But for example, days of the week backward could be pretty easy. You know, patients who might have inattention is going to be able to do that. But sometimes the arithmetic one, so I have had a bad sleep. Sometimes I can't do negative seven sometimes, right? But months of the year backward, it's everybody uses it. Everybody uses the months. Everybody knows the months. And so, but then it is hard. You'll see patients who get days of the week backward really well, when you ask them to do months of the year backward, it becomes a bit difficult. And, you know, we're not using this to say that, oh, look, we found you, but we can also actually use this to understand what the baseline attention is. And if they're able to do, you know, months of the year back up until June yesterday, and like today, they can only do like up till October, then you know the delirium is getting a little bit worse. Or sometimes the patients get better and they are able to do months of the year backward really fast and, you know, really good. But having said that, all of this is just like a tool that we use to assess for attention, right? And they're not perfect because everyone's neurocognitive baseline is different. And that's also to kind of keep in mind when you're seeing the patient, just because they, if their brain is wired to be able to do really good task oriented things, and, you know, attention is an easy thing to do, or counting backward is an easy thing to do, then they're going to be able to do it even though they might be fully inattentive. So overall clinical pictures as well, when you're doing an interview with the patient, for example, if they are kind of going in and out of different topics and kind of not being able to fully be with you when you're doing an interview, then they could also be counted towards an attention, because you will also see a lot of times, sorry, I'm being sidetracked a little bit, but specifically about attention wise or any type of specific test that we're trying to do, you know, you'll see patients who know that they can't do these tasks. They will say that, I don't want to do it. So that's also something to keep in mind when you're, you know, talking with or in trying to assess these patients.
Well, let's look at this. You're walking into a room and you're assessing someone. I know that there's a lot of variation, but can you give us a picture that the DSM, in this case, sounds like it has a very helpful set of criteria, but what are you seeing clinically, the way that delirium is presenting in the room?
Yeah, so the way the delirium presents is actually just like in any psychiatric illnesses, it presents because of wide spectrum, right? Just kind of giving an example, patients who might have mild depression to moderate to severe or to severe with psychotic features, they're all on the gradient, right? And the patients who are suffering from delirium are also all on the gradient. So on the one hand, we can have a severely hypoactively delirious patient, right? The patient is withdrawn, minimally responsive, and sometimes almost, you know, we get consults where these are patients catatonic because they feel so withdrawn and suffering from hypoactive delirium. On the other hand, you know, patients that when we think about delirium, because we get consults for these cases a lot, is hyperactive delirium, which you'll see, and you don't sometimes even need to go into the room to get to be able to tell, because you'll also be hearing that, you know, screaming, yelling, you know, patients are, you know, very, sometimes are under restraints, you know, they are very angry and they look very also scared. They probably are very paranoid at times as well. So those are more of hyperactive type of cases. And I try to distinguish between them too, because as I said, we get consulted and we recognize hyperactive delirium pretty easily. We don't have to be a psychiatrist or anybody to just kind of say, oh, the patient is pretty hyperactive and delirious. But studies found that actually 75% of the patients who are suffering from delirium are suffering from hypoactive delirium. And as you mentioned, a lot of the misdiagnosis or we're missing the delirium comes from patients who are hypoactive, because these patients who are hyperactive delirious are not going to really, you know, fight. For example, when you're trying to give medications, they're not going to say mean things to the providers or try to swing at them because, you know, they are more hypoactive delirious, right? So those are some of the two symptomatology that we will see when we go see the patient. And it could be all in the gradient. But another thing is that there could be a mixed delirium. So, for example, a patient at nighttime can be super, super, you know, psychomorally agitated, but then during the morning and daytime, they're very subdued. They're very somnolent. So that's also another, you know, phenomenology that we'll see.
And what do we understand about the underlying neurobiology? What's going on in the brain that causes all of these symptoms that you're describing and these changes in mental status?
Yeah, so the widely accepted common denominator of this neurotransmitter theory is the cholinergic deficiency. So that's why we are recommending to not to use anticholinergic medications to our, you know, medicine or primary teams, like including Benadryls or even sometimes, you know, hydroxyzine and things like that. But I think that there are other neurotransmitters that are actually involved as well. For example, excess dopamine, and that might be able to explain why the patients are having the psychotic symptoms. Patients might have excess norepinephrine drive because they are in this flight and fight mode in a way, as well as excess glutamate within their brain, given the fact that they're in more of this excited tone, right? And another thing is along with like melatonin deficiency, as this is one of the neurotransmitters that we kind of forget about because it is really crucial in terms of regulating circadian rhythm that helps with the sleep-wake cycle. But the important thing to note is there's no single neurotransmitter pattern that underlies all delirium. It's very multi-mechanistic. And hence, you know, we can discuss a little bit about the symptom management of delirium a little bit later in the episode, but there isn't like a one medication that I would prefer one versus the other. It's all very clinically dependent.
Although for the anticholinergics, we definitely know. I mean, that's one that you definitely will not favor in this case.
Yes, that's right. That's right. It's the anticholinergic medications. We would definitely try to avoid it as much as possible with medications who have significant anticholinergic property.
And can you just name a few? I mean, you mentioned Benadryl, hydroxyzine, which are things that we sometimes use to calm people down or to help them sleep, but obviously our own antidepressants and other medications can have anticholinergic properties. So what are some of the ones that you always are flagging for providers?
One example can be TCAs. Tricyclic antidepressants, like amitriptyline, for example, is significantly anticholinergic. I believe Paxil is also somewhat anticholinergic as well. And I just have to kind of talk about benzodiazepines here. The reason why we try to avoid benzodiazepine is because overall it decreases the cholinergic tone of the OR patients within the brain. So we want to try to avoid benzodiazepine as well. Having said that, so there's always caveat to, I never use a specific medication, right? Because sometimes in the patients, for example, the patients with delirious in setting of benzo withdrawal, and we are trying to do everything to minimize benzodiazepine, but sometimes we have to use them to help the patient be out of the delirious state. Another medication that I try to take away is benztropine. You know, a lot of patients are on benztropine because of sometimes like a prophylaxis or EPS and things like that. But you'll see patients who come in who have been on this benztropine forever, who are on antipsychotic medications that doesn't cause too much EPS. And so when I see that, I try to also take away the patient's clearly delirious and kind of see for any emergence of another EPS. If that's the case, then we will, you know, resume the anticholinergic medication as benztropine. But, you know, it's always important to kind of keep in mind whenever we get consulted for delirium, we review the medication list that the patient is on to avoid worsening of anticholinergic tone the patient is already on. Another thing to actually think about other than neurotransmitter is there are more and more studies that are coming out that are indicating that there is a network level failure within the brain when the patients are delirious. For example, the default mode network and the salience network appears to be particularly affected. The salience network specifically or normally acts as a switch directing attention between the resting default mode network to a task focused state, but it seems to be disrupted in specific nodes. And, you know, when you start using the regulatory capacity, patients will still start having inattention as well as fluctuating mental status.
And you think that this is related to some inflammatory state or some kind of imbalance just more generally in the system?
Yeah, there are studies that indicate that it could be due to inflammation within the brain as well. And so it could be symptoms of all the delirium. Like it could be like it's like a chicken and the egg type of situation. Delirium itself can also cause inflammation, or it could be the inflammation markers that are causing patients to have disturbances within the brain.
Well, Jeff, just to quickly, because I know you could probably talk for 45 minutes about this, but quickly give an overview of the psychopharm options that you think about when you're dealing with patients who are suffering from delirium.
Yes. So as I briefly mentioned in previous answer, so it's first could be antipsychotic medications in patients who are showing some psychotic symptoms, such as hallucinations and paranoid ideations. I would like to start with Haldol first. And Haldol has this bad rep of causing prolonged QTC out of the antipsychotics, but more and more studies are indicating that's not the case. If you are worried about QTC prolongation, you shouldn't be using any antipsychotics whatsoever. So haloperidol is my go-to because, as I mentioned before, it is one of the least anticholinergic antipsychotics. We use Zyprexa quite a bit in our setting, but Zyprexa is very anticholinergic medications, so I try to avoid that if we can. Another antipsychotics that I use is quetiapine. Sometimes I also do use risperidol, especially in patients who we think that might have some type of dementia with behavior disturbances at a baseline. We might have to think about using that as ongoing symptomatic management, even after a patient gets discharged. With the black box warning, of course, we have to say that, right? And if the patients are showing more of agitations, things like that, where without too much psychotic symptoms, I do tend to use valproic acid quite often. It is to kind of reduce the hyperglutamatergic tone that we kind of discussed. And if the liver function is not doing too well, I sometimes use gabapentinoids, such as pregabalin and gabapentin. Now, it's not using GABA. It's not GABAergic medication. It actually reduces the glutamate release from the presynaptic neurons of the glutamatergic presynaptic neurons. So, you know, we shouldn't be confused with that, with the gabapentin pregabalin versus, for example, lorazepam, right? So I use the gabapentin pregabalin quite a bit. Another medication that I like to use is guanfacine, especially in patients who are showing more of this flight and fight type of symptoms, agitations, anxiety, and things like that. We definitely use that, especially in the patients who are we try to come off of Precedex, for example, because they share the same mechanism of action as an alpha-2 agonist.
Well, let's turn to the impact of delirium. I mentioned some severe kind of outcomes in my introduction. Could you speak about what the morbidity and mortality is that results from delirium?
Yeah. So this is why hospital administrations and hospitals should really pay attention to patients who are suffering from delirium, because it's that, you know, in one study in 2018 showed that the hospital mortality of just 33% for hypoactive delirious patients, and sometimes 15% for hyperactive. Now, that kind of tells us, again, hypoactive delirious patients are at increased risk for mortality. And even in the ICU setting, for example, in 2021, prospective studies showed that hypoactive delirium was associated with about 3x-fold of increased risk of death the following day, while the hyperactive delirium was not significantly associated with that in hospital mortality. Now, having said that, that's not, you know, changing the fact that the hyperactive delirium, any patients who are suffering from delirium will have a much, much higher mortality and morbidity rate, as you mentioned earlier in the podcast.
So is most of that increased mortality for hypoactive because they're less obvious in the hospital, or is it because of the actual impact biologically that is, you know, represented by hypoactive delirium?
I think it's both. So patients who are more critically ill, who are really, really ill, they might not even have energy to be hyperactively delirious, right? Or it could be that, you know, they get missed and we just continue to give medications that might be making them more delirious and just be hypoactively delirious. So it could be both.
What's the time course? I mean, I this is on my mind, having a family member who's dealing with this. Once you've gotten, you know, to deal with the underlying problem, which we'll talk a little bit more about what those are, when do you expect people to show signs of improvement, and how much over what period of time?
It's a tricky question because I get asked this question a lot by both the primary team as well as the our loved ones and the family members, because it's very hard to see your loved ones kind of go through this. And I want to take this moment to say, you know, you're going through quite a bit. So, you know, hang in there.
Thank you. And you can tell what's motivating the question, obviously. It's a little selfish yeah. here, but yeah, no, thanks.
No, it's not selfish at all. It's very, very important question, because we think that, oh, then once the medical condition has been resolved, the patients are going to be great. They are now going to be delirium free. But that's not really the case. Studies found, as well as, you know, my anecdotal experience and, you know, personal experience, shows that that's not the case. That's just simply not true. The delirium is not simply transient, and it may not be self-limited. For example, in hospitalized patients, you know, delirium typically lasts about 1 week. That's just typically. However, 45% of the geriatric patients still meets criteria even at the discharge. And roughly about 21% still have persistent symptoms at 6 months. Now, in patients with underlying dementia, so patients who already have diagnosis of dementia, the outcomes are a little bit worse. Only 6% achieve full recovery, even at 1 month follow-up, compared to 14% in those without dementia. So, you know, whenever I answer this question, I always say I hate answering this question, because I say it really depends on how well the patient has been doing prior to coming in, what their functional statuses, as well as how sick they were or they are, and also what the aftercare, what the prolonged course is going to look like. And so I can't really fully give a specific timeline, but I will say, this is like in my generic answer, the average is about 1 week. However, things can continue to be persistent, even the patient might be discharged from the hospital.
What are the risk factors for delirium?
I mean, it's very multifactorial, but as I just mentioned in my prior answers, the strongest and most consistent risk factor is dementia, as well as pre-existing cognitive impairment. Beyond that, sometimes like advanced age, and functional impairments, so for example, patients with vision or hearing loss, or patients who are frail or have also decreased physical mobility are at higher risk for delirium. High comorbid burden, or even patients with substance use history and prior psychiatric history that I mentioned, they're all risk factors for delirium.
So beyond the risk factors, this is a condition unlike other psychiatric conditions that we're treating as primary psychiatric conditions. This is a condition that's caused by medical problems. So what are the medical causes that are most typical for delirium?
Any medical causes that might indicate like inpatient hospitalization, for example, because patients who are hospitalized have higher risk of developing delirium itself, right? So in patients with, UTI, for example, can develop delirium. Pneumonia can develop delirium. Any type of acute insults to their organs, any, liver issues, kidney issues, lung issues, including, I just mentioned pneumonia, but patients who are in ICU settings, like for ARDS, patients who are becoming encephalopathic in the setting of hepatic encephalopathy and uremia due to their kidney functions not working that well. They all are at high risk for delirium.
You had mentioned earlier, that withdrawal is something
So substance withdrawals are big, big factors in patients who are suffering from delirium, because a lot of times you'll see that the patients are, again, this is why it's so multifactorial, patients who are probably already going through withdrawal, they might also have a significant medical complication. And that kind of complicates things much farther in terms of how to manage delirium.
When you're assessing someone for delirium during a consult, what are the other diagnoses that you keep in mind? You talked about the DSM criteria and how, it can't be something else if it meets the criteria. So are there conditions that you want to be on the lookout for that could be mistaken for delirium, or even things that might be missed because there's delirium that would hide those other conditions?
Yeah, I think for hyperactive delirium, it could be obvious that like the patients might appear psychotic with a conservative primary psychosis. More patients might have like a manic episode. Patients who might face a bipolar disorder. But actually, a lot of times in hypoactively delirious patient, we don't really get consulted for a consult for hypoactive delirium, but it's actually consult for either depression or sometimes suicidal ideation. Because there's a lot of data that shows that patients report suicidal ideation during their hypoactive delirious episodes, and they don't remember once they're out of that state. So those are some of the things that I always keep in mind. Another thing I did mention is catatonia, right? Patients who are very hypoactively delirious may appear catatonic. And if you actually score Bush Francis on this, hypoactively delirious patients, it's going to be really, really high. And so it's very important to kind of distinguish them. But sometimes we have to understand, patients who are catatonic might also be delirious as well. And it's not just mutually exclusive things, because catatonia itself is just constellation of symptoms, right? That you kind of see what's, happening, but there's always an underlying cause of it. So can we say patients are catatonic in setting of hypoactive delirious? Maybe, but this is always to kind of keep in mind, especially when the patient has primary psychiatric illnesses. That might be indicative of developing catatonia.
You brought up the suicidal ideation and how that can sometimes elicit a consult that then you discover someone has hypoactive delirium. I'm curious how you treat that kind of SI as a consultation liaison psychiatrist. Is it just the same safety protocols and all of that as if somebody else had expressed suicidal ideation? Is it different? And is there actually like a higher incidence of suicide associated with delirium?
So I think patients who suffer from, let's just talk about from acutely as well as kind of chronically. So patients who are suffering in acute hypoactive delirium and is reporting suicidal ideation. And when we go see the patient, a lot of times they are going back and forth with the suicidality or depression. Sometimes they wax and wane. And in those cases, I would just, you know, recommend more of like a safety watch, more so than like a suicide watch, one-to-one, things like that, because, you know, they might be more confused, they might be more impulsive, things like that. But, you know, there will be some times where it's kind of iffy, where patients do have history of depressive disorder, do have history of suicide attempts. And when you're assessing the patient, you know, they're kind of saying all the suicidal things. So sometimes they have to, you know, implement suicide watch and, you know, do exactly this, follow the exact same protocol that we have for patients that are at acute risk. I don't know if there has been like a specific study that has been done in patients who had an acute hypoactive delirium with a suicide event that happened within the hospital setting. However, there are multiple studies that shows that patients who are suffering from delirium, you know, might develop worsening of functioning once they leave from the hospital, and that could lead to increased risk of suicide in patients. So it's not, I don't know if it's a direct like causation, but there could definitely be a correlation with, if you kind of look at it more of a chronically about what hypoactive delirium can cause. But in terms of how to treat them, again, we, depending on how the patient is appearing, we might implement either safety watch or suicide watch. Sometimes we might give a little bit of like aripiprazole, like a low dose aripiprazole, to kind of help with partial dopamine agonism, to see, because there has been some study that indicates that Abilify does help with hypoactive delirium. Sometimes we give a little bit of a stimulant as well to kind of wake them up in the morning. And once their medical illness does clear up and they're better, and when you ask them, hey, do you remember me? They're like, no, who are you? And they go, you told me that you wanted to end your life. And it's like, me, never. I would never say that. So most of the cases comes that way. But it's a case by case as well, because there are some times where patients are actually suicidal and their depressed mood kind of enhances when they're, you know, hypoactive with delirious. And once they're out of delirium, they're still saying they will still want to end their life because their life is miserable, their, you know, health condition is not great, then, you know, you have to continue with suicide watch and follow the protocol. Yeah.
Nuance is very important in this, obviously, in everything you've discussed today. There's no one size fits all. Another area of complexity when we think about all psychiatric care is cultural factors and how they play into the diagnosis and treatment. I'm curious, has there been research that looks at how healthcare disparities impact those diagnosed with delirium in the hospital?
Yes, I think this is an important and under-recognized issue. I think there was actually a large 2025 study that was done over 260,000 hospitalized older adults. And in that study, non-Hispanic Black patients had about 49% higher odds of delirium present on admission and 39% higher odds of hospital-acquired delirium as well. And Hispanic patients had about 31% and as well as 28% higher odds, respectively. It could be due to the fact, as we all know, that there is significant factors of socioeconomic disparities in general well-being and health of patients, right? So their patients could be a lot more complex when the patients are already coming into the hospital, and the increased medical complication can affect, increase the risk of delirium as well. Interestingly, there was a recent trauma surgery study that actually found lower documented delirium rates in Hispanic patients. But the concern isn't actually true lower incidences. It likely actually reflected underdiagnosis due to language barriers or implicit biases, and that distinction matters, you know, importantly for clinically and research-wise.
These kind of disparities impact every aspect of treatment in psychiatry and medicine, so it's not surprising to hear how they applied in delirium as well. I want to turn to treatment. You've touched a bit on some areas of treatment, but let's dive in a little more closely into that. You talked about how the primary treatment is addressing effectively the underlying medical issues. What recommendations do you provide when you're consulted by a primary team to help them take care of a patient?
So I always start with making sure that our nursing colleagues are also involved in communication, especially for these patients, because our primary team will place the order in, but then it actually, the nurses, nursing colleagues are the ones who are actually, you know, carrying them out in a way. And they are the ones who actually hands-on, you know, taking care of the patients a lot of times. So I, you know, whenever there is a complex patient, I always speak directly to the nurse who is actually taking care of the patient primarily to kind of help them guide through this. This should be done for any patients who are in the hospital who are at even risk for delirium or who are suffering from delirium. As first, we have to make sure they ask for frequent reorientation. Whenever we go in, we ask them, this is what I always do, introduce myself, tell them the date they're here at Weill Cornell Hospital for this specific reasons. Of course, if I want to assess for a patient, the orientation, things like that, then I would kind of hold that back. But for our nursing colleagues who are taking care of patients all the time, it is important for them to kind of reorient the patient all the time, every time they go in to speak with them. Another thing is I would recommend to really protect the patient's sleep-wake cycle. For example, I don't know if anyone, I'm sure a lot of, you know, some folks have been in hospital setting and they were admitted just even overnight or a day or two. It is really hard to sleep. It is so hard to sleep. And we know that sleep-wake cycle is symptoms. It could be one of the symptoms of delirium, but it could also be disturbance of sleep-wake cycle can also be the precipitant of hyperactive delirious episodes and things like that. So I always kind of speak with the primary team as well as our nursing colleagues, like, hey, do we really have to do vital sign checks on this lady overnight who is otherwise medically stable, but is having this, you know, bouts of nocturnal behavioral agitations? Do you think maybe we should try to give medication a bit earlier during the daytime rather than, you don't have to give atorvastatin at like 10 p.m. You can just, you know, put it in the morning or even give it a little bit earlier, you know, or on like 7 p.m., things like that. So making sure that we can do everything that we can do to protect our sleep-wake cycle by minimizing unnecessary nighttime interruptions, of course, within the bounds of safe clinical and a treatment. Another thing that I recommend is early mobilization. You know, get the physical therapist involved right away as soon as possible. Said that we can't really show a picture here, but, you know, in patients who are like on ECMO machines, for example, you know, we from ICU, we get them up and we walk them around. There's no reasons why if the patients are not physically able to, the patient should stay in the bed, right? And I recommend them to, even during the daytime, try to see if they can make the bed into more of a chair position, because the patients themselves, even engaging the core as they're kind of sitting up in the bed, actually activates the brain, right? And that can actually help reduce delirium. And if the patient is strong enough and safe enough to be out of bed and in the chair as soon as possible, that is really, really crucial. And that's really, really important. Making sure that the patient's hearing, if any patients with hearing impairment or any type of sensory impairment, that they do have their glasses and the hearing aids, because that itself can just fix, or they itself can actually help patients with preventing from having more episodes of delirium. And lastly, I would review the chart and the medication list and to see if there's anything that we can reduce or eliminate any deliriogenic medications. We didn't really, so for example, like anticholinergic medications, and I didn't really talk about too much in the prior ones, but for example, opioids can also be a significant cause of delirium. We think about anticholinergic medications and benzodiazepines because we know that it does cause delirium, and we always kind of hone in on that, but actually studies found opioids are the most significant culprit of causing delirium, and it's kind of difficult because we know the pain itself can be precipitant of delirium, right? So managing pain is very important, but trying to manage pain with the least amount of opioid use possible would be, as with addition of different medications to reduce the pain for patients, is also very, very important.
When I listen to you discuss all of this, and I think about the fact, as we talked about earlier, that this is a public health issue, it's a hospital quality of care issue. Why isn't it protocolized in the way that we have protocols for sepsis or other things? I mean, these are steps that could be taken for patients both to prevent delirium and to help recover from delirium. Is it, do you know, I mean, with NCL, is what, why this hasn't been adopted more widely, or what's going on in terms of these kinds of protocols?
Yeah, so it's, I think there are a lot of implementations that has been tried in the past, and we are actually trying to do something right now as well. But when we do like a lot of implementations, for example, I think our nursing colleagues, they have so many different things to click, even for like an Epic, whenever a patient gets admitted, it becomes like, oh, I think it's like a screen tire or something like that, alert tiredness or something. So, you know, we want to try to come up with the most effective tool that kind of takes away burden away from our you know, folks who are caring for the patients in the front line as well. So that's very important. But having said that, I think we are trying to, you know, come up with a specific delirium protocol here at Cornell, and hopefully that gets implemented better. And it's not just like a one person can say, oh, we're going to go with this protocol and everybody should do it, because it needs a buy-in from a lot of different, you know, multidisciplinary team action.
You're bringing nuance to that answer to that question as well, because you're right, it's complicated, and you could actually burden the nurses and the teams that are having to do this if it's not done thoughtfully. So it's actually, and with all that variation, one size fits all protocol isn't going to work for every case of delirium. So that makes sense. We talked earlier about how the time course for this is indeterminate, and the underlying problems for the delirium can persist. Often there's agitation. There's things that can be harmful for the patient or for staff. How do you deal with those kinds of aspects of delirium, and just more generally, what are the ways that you treat delirium other than addressing what the underlying cause is?
The answer, again, is going to be a nuanced answer. There's no single right answer, you know, partly because the comorbidities often limits our medication options that we have, right? For example, like the antipsychotics, you know, patients with QTC prolongations might be difficult, but we work off of our neurotransmitter framework that we created that I kind of discussed before. For example, for hyperdopaminergic states, the patients who are in acute psychotic state, we do use antipsychotics. But for patients who are in excess glutamate state, you know, we can use either valproic acid or gabapentinoids. Or in patients who might have excess norepinephrine state that we kind of see, and we can actually use the alpha-2 agonists such as guanfacine or, you know, dexmedetomidine in the ICU setting. Having said that, you know, these medications are not treatment of delirium. You know, treatment of delirium is treating the underlying medical illness. These are more used for symptomatic management. And we usually use this in the patients who are, as you mentioned in this question, where patients are agitated and can acutely harm themselves or others, including nursing staff or even our medical staff.
You specifically have extensive experience with delirium in the ICU. Can you speak about why the ICU is a special environment when it comes to the prevalence of delirium, and what are some of the specific ways it can be treated there?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the ICU patients are like the sickest patients in the hospital, right? You don't, you know, just buy yourself way into the ticket to the ICU. It is reserved for patients who are sickest of the sickest. And, you know, when the patients are at increased medical comorbidity, their delirium risk goes high. And some studies report the rate as high as 83% in patients who are in ICU, right? And the consequences are significant, right? The delirium can prolong mechanical ventilation, for example, by interfering with the ability to wind sedation. The patients are on sedative drips, and team often has like struggles to de-escalate these sedative drips, such as propofol or dexmedetomidine drips, when patients are delirious, because they're not able to really fully follow the commands. They're not really able to. They sometimes overbreathe the ventilator setting, so it's kind of hard to take them out. And we know the longer the patients are intubated, the longer the patients are in the ICU, the morbidity and mortality kind of increases. So we want to try to help bridge that gap with with, you know, targeted psychotropics to facilitate extubation and shortening the ICU stays.
Given that it's so prevalent in the ICU and the ICU is this intensive environment, what is the long-lasting psychological impact of delirium on those who recover?
So there are multiple domains of lasting impact of delirium on patients who are trying to recover from their recent medical illness. First could be psychological impact, as well as physical impact and cognitive impact, right? I'll just kind of sum it up with a, kind of describing the post-intensive care syndrome, for example. Because patients who are in the ICU settings who have developed delirium, they are suffering from everything that we kind of mentioned with physical, cognitive, and mental health sequelae that even persist after ICU discharges. So, for example, psychiatrically, patients have, you know, suffer significantly from depression, anxiety, as well as PTSD. And PTSD actually ranges from about 19 to 22% in general ICU survivors and about up to 44% in ARDS survivors. That's acute respiratory distress syndrome, and patients usually get intubated in the ICU setting. And as you can imagine, that could actually be very detrimental to their recovery because the thing about PTSD is the patients who are suffering from PTSD symptoms will try to avoid anything that would remind them of their trauma. And they don't want to go into the hospital setting. They don't want to go get the treatment because it kind of brings up the flashback memories of the delirious episodes that they might have had, or even unpleasant episodes that they had, meaning they're awake and they're intubated and things like that. So though these are very, very important things to consider because it affects the trajectory of the patient's overall improving healthcare, right? And so a lot of PICS clinics are actually being established in academic centers to address this longitudinally. And this, I do believe, is where psychiatry has a specific real role in it. And there are more and more of my colleagues in CL psychiatry who are kind of more specializing in this, the post-ICU clinics, to kind of address the long-lasting impact of psychological impact of delirium.
Well, as a CL psychiatrist, you're helping the patient, you're really supporting the team, but I know that you interact a lot with the families of the patients. I'm curious about the conversations that you typically have with them about delirium and what are the best ways to support them through all of this?
I think more so than the patients themselves, a lot of times the families are really significantly distressed because they see their loved ones suffering so much from this acute change in their mental status, whether that be, you know, having hallucinations or their, you know, loved ones are paranoid or have never been agitated in their entire life, but then they are like, you know, throwing, you know, everything at you know, nursing staff or even to family members. So it's very important to kind of give support to family. And there are three things that I always do, right? The first is education. Second is reassurance. Third is empowerment, okay? Because if we actually are able to explain what delirium is and set realistic expectation about the timeline due we actually talked about, it kind of gives them more of something to kind of hold on to, right? To kind of have an understanding of, okay, so this is not my, for example, like this is not my, you know, parents going, you know, psychotic or things like that. It's just, you know, part of the delirium. And I always tell them about the 75% of patients who are suffering from delirium and things like that. So it kind of helps them understand where the patient is. But also it's very important to acknowledge the emotional toll it takes on the family members, because a lot of times, after, you know, when I kind of describe, hey, you guys are kind of suffering quite a bit, and they, you know, most folks kind of do say that, oh, thank you so much for actually acknowledging that, because yes, we are. And that actually helps, because for me and for the primary team, it's very important to family to be engaged and to be involved, because a familiar face as well as voice can be much more meaningfully helpful than a Haldol or a DEPA code or PRN or things like that, because that, you know, really helps reduce the symptoms of delirium, because they trust the family a lot more than this doctors and nurses who were messed up coming in different times for a period of time. So it's very important to kind of address all three: education, reassurance, as well as empowerment for our family members.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you for all of what you talked about today. I want to finish with one question for you. You are a CL psychiatrist who works with all of those people we mentioned, but also residents and medical students. When you're talking to people about delirium, what are the few basic facts, the take-home points that you wish everyone knew?
So the theme of this this episode, it is very nuanced. When we think about delirium, we just think about as hyperactively delirious patients who are getting, you know, really, really suffering from psychosis or even like manic symptoms. But it's not that, right? Again, 75% of the patients are suffering from mostly sometimes hypoactive delirious. And there are a lot of different ways to approach patients who are suffering from delirium and understand that this acute state that we are seeing right now can actually be a very significant burden to the patient, even though they quote unquote recover from the medical illness, as well as to family members. So we're not just seeing this patient episodically to kind of give them PRN as needed medication or sending like antipsychotic medication, but you have to kind of always take a step back to kind of understand and look at the whole picture of who this patient is and to find the best ways to have the patient be back to their normal baseline, whether that would be cognitively, physically, as well as psychologically.
You said it. You summed it all up. Well, Jeff, I really appreciate you joining me today to speak about delirium. You gave me and everybody who's listening a really detailed picture of what this condition looks like, what we need to do when we are confronting it. And I hope that it helped those who listen gain a better understanding of this topic, because as we've said over and over again, this is very common. It's not always understood and it's often missed. So I hope we've helped dispel some of that just by talking about it with each other today. So thank you so much, Jeff.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you to all who listened today to Jeff and I speak about this topic here on this podcast, On the Mind. We are the official podcast of the Weill Cornell Medicine Department of Psychiatry. Our podcast is available on all of the major audio streaming platforms. And if you like what you heard, please give us a rating. I think we could use more ratings out there on Spotify, on Apple Podcasts, YouTube, wherever you're listening, please give us a rating. And hopefully, because you enjoyed it, you're giving us a 5-star rating. And then if you subscribe, you'll stay up to date with all of our latest episodes. And you can also tell your friends so they'll come and listen as well. We'll be back again next month with another episode. Until then, wishing you good health in body and mind.
Back to Health is your source for the latest in health, wellness, and medical care for the whole family. Our team of world-renowned physicians at Weill Cornell Medicine are having in-depth conversations covering trending health topics, wellness tips, and medical breakthroughs. With the spotlight on our collaborative approach to patient care, the series will present cutting-edge treatments, innovative therapies, as well as real-life stories that will answer common questions for both patients and their caregivers. Subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Also, don't forget to rate us 5 stars.
All information contained in this podcast is intended for informational and educational purposes. The information is not intended nor suited to be a replacement or substitute for professional medical treatment or for professional medical advice relative to a specific medical question or condition. We urge you to always seek the advice of your physician or medical professional with respect to your medical condition or questions. Weill Cornell Medicine makes no warranty, guarantee, or representation as to the accuracy or sufficiency of the information featured in this podcast, and any reliance on such information is done at your own risk. Participants may have consulting, equity, board membership, or other relationships with pharmaceutical, biotech, or device companies unrelated to their role in this podcast. No payments have been made by any company to endorse any treatments, devices, or procedures, and Weill Cornell Medicine does not endorse, approve, or recommend any product, service, or entity mentioned in this podcast. Opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the speaker and do not represent the perspectives of Weill Cornell Medicine as an institution.